Chapter 40. The manifest disapproval of the Mountain Madonna had turned the scales against some economic measure which threatened the rights of her augurs. De Crucis understood the force of these traditional influences. But Odo, in common with the more cultivated men of his day, had lived too long in an atmosphere of polite skepticism to measure the profound hold of religion on the consciousness of the people. Christ had been so long banished from the drawing room that it was as hard to believe that he still ruled in field and vineyard. To men of Odo's stamp, the piety of the masses was a mere superficial growth, a kind of mental mold, to be dried off by the first beams of knowledge. He did not conceive it as a habit of thought so old that it had become instinctive, so closely intertwined with every sense, that to hope to eradicate it was like trying to drain all the blood from a man's body without killing him. He knew nothing of the unwearied workings of that power, patient as a natural force, which, to reach spirits darkened by ignorance and eyes dulled by toil, had stooped to a thousand disguises, humble, tender and grotesque, peopling the earth with a new race of avenging or protecting deities, guarding the babe in the cradle and the cattle in the stalls, blessing the good man's vineyard or blighting the crops of the blasphemer, guiding the lonely traveler over torrents and precipices, smoothing the sea and hushing the whirlwind, praying with the mother over her sick child, and watching beside the dead inn. Plague house and Lazarus and galley entering into every joy and grief of the obscurest consciousness, penetrating to depths of misery which no human compassion ever reached, and redressing by a prompt and summary justice wrongs, of which no human legislation took account. Odo's first act after his accession had been to recall the political offenders banished by his predecessor, and so general was the custom of marking the opening of a new reign by an amnesty to political exiles, that Tresker offered no opposition to the measure. Andriani and his friends at once returned to Pianura, and Gamba at the same time emerged from his mysterious hiding place. He was the only one of the group who struck Odo as having any administrative capacity, yet he was more likely to be of use as a pamphleteer than as an officeholder. As to the other philosophers, they were what their name implied. Thoughtful and high-minded men, with a generous conception of their civic duties, and a noble readiness to fulfill them at any cost, but untrained to action, and totally ignorant of the complex science of government. Odo found the hunchback changed. He had withered like Tresker, but under the harsher blight of physical privations, and his tongue had an added bitterness. He replied evasively to all inquiries as to what had become of him during his absence from Pianura, but on Odo's asking for news of Mamola and the child, he said coldly, "They are both dead." "Dead?" Odo exclaimed. "Together?" "There was scarce an hour between them," Gamba answered. "She said she must keep alive as long as the boy needed her, after that she turned on her side and died." "But of what disorder? How came they to sicken at the same time?" The hunchback stood silent, his eyes on the ground. Suddenly he raised them and looked full at the Duke. "Those that saw them called it the plague." "The plague? Good God!" Odo slowly returned his stare. "Is it possible?" He paused. "Hatchie too was at the feast of the Madonna?" "She was there, but it was not there that she contracted the distemper." "Not there, no, for she dragged herself from her bed to go." There was another silence. The hunchback had lowered his eyes. The Duke sat motionless, resting his head on his hand. Suddenly he made a gesture of dismissal. 2 months after his state entry into Pianura, Odo married his cousin's widow. It surprised him, in looking back, to see how completely the thought of Maria Clementina had passed out of his life, how wholly he had ceased to reckon with her as one of the factors in his destiny. At her child's deathbed, he had seen in her only the stricken mother, centered in her loss, and recalling, in an agony of tears, the little prince's prophetic vision of the winged playmates who came to him carrying toys from paradise. After Prince Farron's death, as he had gone on a long visit to her uncle of Monte Loro, and since her return to Pianura, as he had lived in the dower house, refusing Odo's offer of a palace in the town. She had first shown herself to the public on the day of the state entry, and now, her year of widowhood over, she was again the consort of a reigning Duke of Pianura. No one was more ignorant than her husband of the motives determining her act. As Duchess of Monte Loro, she might have enjoyed the wealth and independence which her uncle's death had bestowed on her, but in marrying again she resigned the right to her new possessions, which became vested in the crown of Pianura. Was it love that had prompted the sacrifice? As she stood beside him on the altar steps of the cathedral, as she rode home beside him between their shouting subjects, Odo asked himself the question again and again. The years had dealt lightly with her, and as he had crossed the threshold of the 30s with the assured step of a woman who has no cause to fear what awaits her. But her blood no longer spoke her thoughts, and the transparence of youth had changed to a brilliant density. He could not penetrate beneath the surface of her smile. She seemed to him like a beautiful toy which might conceal a lacerating weapon. Meanwhile, between himself and any better understanding of her stood the remembrance of their talk in the hunting lodge of Pontesordo. What she had offered then he had refused to take. Was she the woman to forget such a refusal? Was it not rather, to keep its memory alive, that as he had married him? Or was she, but the flighty girl he had once imagined her, driven hither and thither by spasmodic impulses, and incapable of consistent action, whether for good or ill? The barrier of their past, of all that lay unsaid and undone between them, so completely cut her off from him that he had, in her presence, the strange sensation of a man who believes himself to be alone yet feels that he is watched. The first months of their marriage were oppressed by this sense of constraint, but gradually habit bridged the distance between them, and he found himself at once nearer to her, and less acutely aware of her. In the second year an heir was born and died, and the hopes and grief thus shared drew them insensibly into the relation of the ordinary husband and wife, knitted together at the roots in spite of superficial divergencies. In his passionate need of sympathy and counsel, Odo longed to make the most of this enforced community of interests. Already his first zeal was flagging, his belief in his mission wavering. He needed the encouragement of a kindred faith. He had no hope of finding in Maria Clementina that pure passion for justice which seemed to him the noblest ardor of the soul. He had read it in one woman's eyes, but these had long been turned from him. Unconsciously, perhaps, he counted rather on his wife's less generous qualities. The passion for dominion, the blind arrogance of temper that, for the mere pleasure of making her power felt, had so often drawn her into public affairs. Might not this waste force, which implied, after all, a certain prodigality of courage, be used for good as well as evil? Might not his influence make of the undisciplined creature at his side an unconscious instrument in the great work of order and reconstruction? His first appeal to her brought the answer. At his request, his ministers had drawn up a plan of financial reorganization, which should include the two duchies, for Monte Loro, though wealthier than Pianura, was in even greater need of fiscal reform. As a first step towards replenishing the treasury, the Duke had declared himself ready to limit his private expenditure to a fixed sum, and he now asked the Duchess to pledge herself in the same manner. Maria Clementina, since her uncle's death, had been in receipt of a third of the annual revenues of Monte Loro. This should have enabled her to pay her debts and put some dignity and order into her establishment. But the first year's income had gone in the building of a villa on the Piana, in imitation of the country seats along the Brenta. The second was spent in establishing a menagerie of wild animals like that of the French queen at Versailles, and rumor had it that the Duchess carried her imitation of her royal cousin so far as to be involved in an ugly quarrel with her jewelers about a necklace for which she owed 1,000 ducats. All these reports had of course reached Odo, but he still hoped that an appeal to her love of dominion might prove stronger than the habit of self-indulgence. He said to himself that nothing had ever been done to rouse her ambition, that hitherto, if as he had meddled in politics, it had been merely from thwarted vanity or the desire to gratify some personal spite. Now he hoped to take her by higher passions, and by associating her with his own schemes to utilize her dormant energies. For the first moments she listened with the strained fixity of a child, then her attention flickered and died out. The lifelong habit of referring every question to a personal standpoint made it difficult for her to follow a general argument, and she leaned back with the resigned eyelids of piety under the pulpit. Odo, resolved to be patient, and seeing that the subject was too large for her, tried to take it apart, putting it before her bit by bit, and at such an angle that she should catch her own reflection in it. He thought to take her by the Austrian side, touching on the well-known antagonism between Vienna and Rome, on the reforms of the Tuscan Grand Duke, on the Emperor Joseph's open defiance of the Church's feudal claims. But she scented a personal application. My cousin the emperor should be a priest himself, she shrugged, for he belongs to the preaching order. He never goes to France, but he gives the poor queen such a scolding that her eyes are red for a week. Has Joseph been trying to set our house in order? Discouraged, but more than ever bent on patience, he tried the chord of vanity, of her love of popularity. The people called her the beautiful Duchess, why not let history name her the great? But the mention of history was unfortunate. It reminded her of her lesson books, and of the stupid Greeks and Romans, whose dates she could never recall. She hoped she should never be anything so dull as an historical personage. And besides, greatness was for the men, it was enough for a princess to be virtuous. And she looked as edifying as her own epitaph. He caught this up and tried to make her distinguish between the public and the private virtues. But the word responsibility slipped from him, and he felt her stiffen. This was preaching, and she hated preaching even more than history. Her attention strayed again, and he rallied his forces in a last appeal. But he knew it was a lost battle. Every argument broke against the close front of her indifference. He was talking a language as he had never learned it was all as remote from her as church Latin. A princess did not need to know Latin. She let her eye linger suggestively on the clock. It was a fine hunting morning, and she had meant to kill a stag in the Caccia del Vescovo. When he began to sum up, and the question narrowed to a direct appeal, her eyes left the clock and returned to him. Now she was listening. He pressed on to the matter of retrenchment. Would she join him? Would she help to make the great work possible? At first she seemed hardly to understand, but as his meaning grew clear to her, "Is the money no longer ours?" she exclaimed. He hesitated. I suppose it is as much ours as ever, he said. And how much is that? She asked impatiently. It is ours as a trust for our people. She stared in honest wonder. These were new signs in her heaven. A trust? A trust? I am not sure that I know what that means. Is the money ours or theirs? He hesitated. I in strict honor, it is ours, only as long as we spend it for their benefit. She turned aside to examine an enameled patch box by Van Blarenberg which the court jeweler had newly received from Paris. When she raised her eyes she said, "And, if we do not spend it for their benefit," Odo glanced about the room. He looked at the delicate adornment of the walls, the curtains of lion's damask, the crystal girandoles, the toys in porcelain of Saxony and Sevres, in bronze and ivory and Chinese lacquer, crowding the tables and cabinets of inlaid wood. Overhead floated a rosy allegory by Luca Giordano. Underfoot lay a carpet of the Royal Manufactory of France, and through the open windows he heard the plash of the garden fountains and saw the alignment of the long green alleys set with the statues of Roman patriots. Then, said he, and the words sounded strangely in his own ears, "and they may take it from us someday and all this with it, to the very toy you are playing with." She rose, and from her fullest height, dropped a brilliant smile on him. Then her eyes turned to the portrait of the great fighting duke set in the monumental stucchi of the chimney piece. "If you take after your ancestors, you will know how to defend it," she said. 4.3. The new duke sat in his closet. The walls had been stripped of their pious relics and lined with books, and above the fireplace hung the Venus of Georgian, liberated at last from her long imprisonment. The windows stood open, admitting the soft September air. Twilight had fallen on the gardens, and through it a young moon floated above the cypresses. On just such an evening 3 years earlier he had ridden down the slope of the Monte Baldo with Fulvia Vivaldi at his side. How often, since, he had relived the incidents of that night. With singular precision they succeeded each other in his thoughts. He felt the wild sweep of the storm across the lake, the warmth of her nearness, the sense of her complete trust in him, then their arrival at the inn, the dazzle of light as they crossed the threshold, and the Crucis confronting them within. He heard her voice pleading with him in every accent that pride and tenderness and a noble loyalty could command. He felt her will slowly dominating his, like a supernatural power forcing him into his destined path. He felt, and with how profound an irony of spirit, the passion of self-dedication in which he had taken up his task. He had known moments of happiness since, moments when he believed in himself and in his calling, and felt himself indeed the man she thought him. That was in the exaltation of the first months, when his opportunities had seemed as boundless as his dreams, and he had not yet learned that the sovereign's power may be a kind of spiritual prison to the man. Since then, indeed, he had known another kind of happiness, had been aware of a secret voice whispering within him that she was right, and had chosen wisely for him. But this was when he had realized that he lived in a prison, and had begun to admire the sumptuous adornment of its walls. For a while the mere external show of power amused him, and his imagination was charmed by the historic dignity of his surroundings. In such a setting, against the background of such a past, it seemed easy to play the benefactor and friend of the people. His sensibility was touched by the contrast, and he saw himself as a picturesque figure linking the new dreams of liberty and equality to the feudal traditions of a thousand years. But this masquerading soon ceased to divert him. The round of court ceremonial wearied him, and books and art lost their fascination. The more he varied his amusements, the more monotonous they became, the more he crowded his life with petty duties, the more empty of achievement it seemed. At first he had hoped to bury his personal disappointments in the task of reconstructing his little state, but on every side he felt a mute resistance to his efforts. The philosophical faction had indeed poured forth pamphlets celebrating his reforms, and comparing his reign to the return of the Golden Age. But it was not for the philosophers that he labored, and the benefits of free speech, a free press, a secular education did not, after all, reach those over whom his heart yearned. It was the people he longed to serve. And the people were hungry, were fever-stricken, were crushed with tithes and taxes. It was hopeless to try to reach them by the diffusion of popular knowledge. They must first be fed and clothed, and before they could be fed and clothed, the chains of feudalism must be broken. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.